Buchenwald, A Dum-Dum Portrayal of Evil. Problem 1, The Lampshade. The story is that when the Americans came into the Buchenwald concentration camp, they found a lampshade made out of tattooed human skin. It was then placed on a table so that 1,000 people from the nearby city of Weimar could be brought in on foot to view what the Nazis had done. The problem is that when you take a lampshade made out of tattooed human skin and place it on a table outside on a sunny day, the sun shines through it, revealing that it's not a lampshade made out of tattooed human skin. One can see that there's no tattoos on it, and there's no stitching seams connecting pieces of human skin. There's just a basic lampshade, which is why this lamp had to disappear after the psychological power of suggestion had created a myth about it. It disappeared so that no one could ever look at it or test it. Problem 2, objectivity in the filmed footage. When the Americans came into Buchenwald, they brought movie cameras to document what they found. Now you would think that the person in charge of filming the camp would be just a basic soldier, maybe a 20-year-old from Nebraska who 2 years earlier was playing varsity high school basketball and working at his dad's camera shop on weekends. Someone with no particular axe to grind. But that's not the case, because we see someone accidentally stepping into the scene as the cameras are rolling. Who is it? It's Billy Wilder, the guy who directed Marilyn Monroe in Some Like It Hot. We go to the Internet Movie Database. Originally planning to become a lawyer, Billy Wilder abandoned that career in favor of working as a reporter for a Viennese newspaper. Using this experience to move to Berlin, where he worked for the city's largest tabloid, he broke into films as a screenwriter in 1929 and wrote scripts for many German films until Adolf Hitler came to power in 1933. Wilder immediately realized his Jewish ancestry would cause problems, so he emigrated to Paris, then the U.S., although he spoke no English when he arrived in Hollywood. So this is someone who does have an axe to grind because the Nazis forced him out of Germany. He doesn't even have to wear a military uniform. He wears the cliché director's garb of all black with a beret. Problem 3, hair length of the shrunken heads. There are 2 shrunken heads on the table. Granted that when a head gets shrunk, the hair will be in a new proportion to the head and will appear longer. But this guy's hands are not shrunk. Wouldn't you say the hair is about as long as the width of his hand, maybe a little longer in the back? Again, if you pulled out these waves, would the hair be as long as the width of these hands? Now look at footage of the inmates. Their hair is all shorn. And European men in general were not wearing their hair that long at the time. An intelligent guess might be that these heads come from South America and were perhaps stolen out of a museum or purchased in a curio shop near the end of the war. Another thing to notice is the pedestal. It looks lopsided, and thus when you cut downward to make the flat surface for the thin brass inscription plate, which, by the way, is missing, then that will be asymmetrical also. But Germany is a country known for exactitude and precision craftsmanship. On this side, it's a beveled lathe thing. And on the other side, it's facets. We're supposed to believe that the German SS would go to all that work to make a shrunken head via a recipe from the South American headhunter tribes, and then put it on a pedestal that would barely get the grade of a C in American high school woodshop. There is a Caucasian shrunken head in a medical museum at Harvard University. We see that a Caucasian shrunken head actually looks Caucasian. The information on the Harvard website gives us an insight into the Buchenwald heads. We read, Shrunken head of Caucasian woman, origin unknown, circa 1935. The above item is a genuine shrunken human head, which was displayed at the Warren Museum for many years as an original Jivaro Indian sansa. To the learned eye, however, it is most assuredly a fake, or at least an unintentional mistake to label it as authentic. Authentic sansas were created as trophies of war and to imprison the vengeful spirits of the murder victims. In certain indigenous South American tribes, such as the Jivaro, if a member of the tribe killed another person, the victim's head was shrunk and ceremonies were performed to trap the victim's spirit in the head to prevent it from harming the murderer. Because the heads were believed to contain a potentially dangerous spirit, great care was taken to prevent its escape through the eyes or mouth. In an authentic sansa, the mouth is tied closed with twine, carbon is rubbed into the skin, and the eyes are sewn closed to prevent the spirit's escape or allow it to see through the head. When the first sansas reached North America and Europe in the mid-19th century, they became very popular as curiosities. A market for genuine sansas rapidly developed, and the demand quickly exceeded the supply. This demand resulted in the manufacture of fake sansas by unscrupulous individuals in South America who were not affiliated in any way with the tribes. Nonetheless, these forgeries were unfailingly represented as being from indigenous South American tribes, such as the Jivaro, and this created confusion about both the meaning and origin of the practice of creating sansas. Like the one pictured above, fake sansas were often made from genuine human material. However, they were easy to spot as forgeries because they did not follow the techniques of the indigenous tribes. The Buchenwald heads are real heads but fake sansas, just like the Caucasian shrunken head at Harvard University. Problem 4, Jewish tattoos. Most of the table is covered with tattoos. These are real pieces of tattooed human skin. Although this one might be a tattoo design on paper, which would explain what appears to be a signature here. For the American public, pieces of tattooed skin are strongly associated with the Holocaust. But tattoos are against Jewish law. If you're Jewish and you have a tattoo, you can't be buried in a Jewish cemetery. That's problematic because cremation is also against Jewish law. There is a dissertation on this table written by a German doctor who was studying tattoos in the camps. This study by Dr. Eric Wagner of the Institute of Forensic Medicine and Scientific Criminology at Friedrich Schiller University is what spawned the tattooed skin rumors at Buchenwald. His interest was how tattoos can relate to criminality. If we are to trust his information, he said that regardless of Jewish law, 3% of Jewish inmates at Buchenwald had tattoos. Now we go to David Hackett's book called The Buchenwald Report to find that at Buchenwald, only 1/5 of the 20,000 inmates were Jewish when it was liberated. That's 4,000 people. If 3% had tattoos, that's only 120 people. In other words, less than 1% of the inmate population at Buchenwald were Jews with tattoos. Now consider that Buchenwald had a significant population of common criminals, and they probably had the highest tattoo rate in all of Europe. So it's unlikely that these tattoos come from Jewish inmates, yet most people who have heard about the Buchenwald tattooed skin think it's Jewish tattooed skin. The lampshade isn't even real, but if it were, it would unlikely be Jewish. And it should be pointed out that Buchenwald is the only place for the entire Holocaust where the evidence of a lampshade and tattooed skin was found. And there are interesting questions about the skin. How do we know that people were killed for their tattoos? Maybe people died natural deaths, and then the tattoos were removed. Or how do we know that the doctor studying tattoos didn't bring the tattoo specimens with him into the camp to compare them with tattoos on living inmates? Here's an article about a Japanese anatomy professor, Susumu Kato, who collects human skin tattoo specimens. Professor Susumu Kato plunges his arms into a blue plastic bin and pulls out what looks like a soggy bundle of technicolor tripe. Carefully, he spreads it out on the stainless steel surface of a dissecting table in the morgue, and gradually, gruesomely, it becomes clear what it is. He goes on to mention how tattooing is often associated with criminals. That's an interest that the German doctor also had, yet no one is accusing this Japanese anatomy professor of killing anyone for their tattoos. Think of the lies someone could make up about him, though. Problem 5, the Ilse Koch anachronistic problem. The story is that someone was behind the operation of removing skins and making lampshades from them. A woman named Ilse Koch, the wife of an early commander of Buchenwald, Karl Koch. In reality, she's probably the most cruelly lied about woman in human history. Let's hear what Holocaust documentaries say about her.
One of the first things they see on entering the camp is the parchment display. On the table is a lamp with a shade fashioned out of human skin, made at the request of the former commandant's wife, Ilse Koch, a strapping redhead of ample proportions, nicknamed the Bitch of Buchenwald. One of her many hobbies was collecting lampshades, book covers, and gloves made of tattooed human skin from dead inmates. On occasion, she gave orders for new prisoners with interesting tattoos to be reserved for her.
One of the first things that the German civilians see as they reach the interior of the camp is the parchment display. On a table for all to gaze upon is a lampshade made of human skin, made at the request of an SS officer's wife.
There is an anachronistic problem, though, because Ilse Koch was no longer at Buchenwald by the time the Americans arrived. She hadn't been there for nearly 2 years. Her husband left Buchenwald in late 1941 to run another camp, and even though Ilse Koch stayed on at Buchenwald a little longer, both were arrested by the SS around July 1943, when an 8-month corruption investigation began that looked into their actions while they were both at Buchenwald. The SS investigator, who also acted as judge, was named Conrad Morgan. He testified about his time at Buchenwald when he took the stand at the Nuremberg trial. He told the court how he temporarily moved to the nearby city of Weimar while his staff lived in the Buchenwald camp itself. Their investigation did not find tattooed skin or lampshades, but did find that Karl Koch had had 3 or 4 inmates killed. For that, Karl Koch was executed by firing squad on the Buchenwald premises a week before the camp was liberated. Ilse Koch was acquitted for lack of evidence. In other words, Morgan never found items like what's shown here on this table. In David Hackett's translation of the Buchenwald report, we read about Morgan's investigation from another perspective, from the writing of an inmate. Keep in mind that Morgan is at Buchenwald, but he's not investigating the current administration. He's investigating events that happened years earlier. And while he conducts his investigation, Ilse Koch is in a Nazi jail. I was called by Dr. Morgan, who led the investigation, to make a deposition as a witness. Of course, I avoided all damaging testimony because I knew that otherwise I myself could be condemned to death. In particular, I was asked whether Frau Koch had satisfied her perverse desires with me. What's amazing about this passage is that an SS judge is going around a concentration camp interviewing inmates about the conduct of a previous camp administration. And it's not a sham investigation, because the former commander of the camp will be executed as a result of it. Conrad Morgan's investigation doesn't fit with the mainstream conception of a concentration camp, where torture and beatings happen every day. For instance, just try to imagine Morgan's investigation as a scene in the movie Schindler's List. But for us, that's not the point. The point is that one can surmise that the current Buchenwald administration, watching Morgan's investigation take place, watching his investigators going around talking to inmates, would have had the impetus to run the camp by the book. The commander who replaced Karl Koch, Hermann Pister, was never accused by the inmates or Americans of shrinking heads or doing anything with tattooed human skin, and he ran the camp from January 1942 on. One can even find examples of inmates saying good things about him. To summarize, to connect Ilse Koch with the tattooed human skin and lampshade on this table, you have to pretend that the last 2 years of the camp's existence never took place. Because Hermann Pister was then in charge, and because Conrad Morgan had done an investigation, and because Ilse Koch wasn't even there. Problem 6. Ilse Koch on the web. We type in Ilse Koch and Buchenwald into Google, and it's always good to weigh the top hits with the prestige of the URL. The second one seems respectable. It's the University of California at Santa Barbara, Professor Harold Marcuse. He's Jewish and a professor of modern German history, and his interest is the Holocaust. This is written by a senior English major who took his Holocaust class. It's titled, Ilse Koch, the Bitch of Buchenwald. There's a minor problem with the title, because Ilse Koch wasn't known as the Bitch of Buchenwald among the inmates of the camp. Inmates tend to give guards nicknames, and she was called Die Hex, which means the witch. The American press probably changed that to bitch because it rhymes with witch in English. And usually in academia, you don't call a woman a bitch, but apparently it's okay here. We scroll down and read, this is a picture of a lampshade made out of human skin found in Koch's apartment. That's totally untrue. This is this piece of skin, and it wasn't found in her apartment. She wasn't even living at the camp. She was living with family members after the Nazis released her from a year in jail. We scroll down and read, Karl was charged and executed in 1945. Except not by the Americans, by the German SS, but that's not mentioned. Then we read, Ilse Koch committed suicide on September 1st, 1947. She's off by 20 years. Ilse committed suicide in 1967 after 20 years in jail and 20 years of the world believing outrageous lies about her. Big surprise that she would want to commit suicide. Here is a 1947 newsreel showing Ilse Koch being tried by the Americans. She's 41 years old, and one of the American interrogators has gotten her pregnant. A shrunken head and tattooed skin are used as evidence to help her get sentenced to life. This piece of skin wasn't on the table, but it's part of that same collection, as can be seen in medical examiner Reuben Kerr's report describing it. He writes, a large bird with a wingspan measuring 28 centimeters is present in the center of the skin upper part. A black dragon is present in the center of the skin. Notice the rough edges lifting off the surface due to warping? It's interesting how pieces like that were sent to the medical examiner, whereas this piece was not. Probably because this piece isn't real and the other one is. This piece still exists today in the U.S. National Museum of Health and Medicine. This one is nowhere to be found. A true intellectual challenge for Marcuse's class would have been to comprehend the surreal hell Ilse found herself in. It's hard to fathom. I wish I could go back in time and give her a big hug, and then rescue her from what really was a modern-day witch trial. It's May 2008 right now, and we see that this has been on the web for over 4 years. What were the students' sources? Wiesenthal Center. This organization advocated the giant fence separating the Palestinians from the Israelis. Wiesenthal Center press release, International Court of Justice's anti-security fence decision would deny Israelis the ultimate human right, the right to live. The MOT stands for Museum of Tolerance. And usisrael.org. Professor Marcuse must have liked the paper. He reviewed the overall project in April 2004, at which time he wrote, "This remains one of the best projects submitted for my Fall 2003 History 33D course. But it's also a project that supports the theory described in the book Culture of Critique, that, on the surface level, Harold Marcuse has the students critiquing historical figures, a process that gives them the feeling that they are the owners of the moral high ground. But what these students never suspect is that under the guise of moral high ground, something more tribal is going on, something more ethnogenetic. When your genetic cohort is 2% of the population, it affects the way you evolve. It's in the past 800 years of your evolution to be hysterically concerned about what the other 98% think." Marcuse is promoting his own genes and the genes of his ethnic group, however unconsciously. The theory explains why Jewish websites and a Jewish professor are dealing with such obviously erroneous information, because it benefits them. This is not to put Marcuse down. It's just using evolution to understand why we do the things we do. It's all good. Could the moral high ground associated with studying the Holocaust really be a front for ethnogenetic determinism? Yes. But a serious thing to understand is the Holocaust myth, under the guise of moral high ground, is literally killing the Palestinians. It's a manipulative myth promoted by the Museum of Good. Problem 7. Buchenwald was documented by psych warfare. There are various intelligence departments that follow the troops into a defeated country and document what they find for future generations. The psych warfare department is not one of them. Psych warfare is more about lying to the enemy in order to manipulate them. To pick from the many examples, we go to the book Psych War, written by a psych war department captain shortly after World War II. For a minute and a half, we're going to be reading about a guy named Tom. He has nothing to do with Buchenwald, but it's necessary that we have an example of the type of thing psych warfare does to help us understand what psych warfare is. Two types of humor used by psych war may be mentioned to illustrate the range of its efforts. One was a regular feature of Radio Luxembourg, broadcast as Corporal Tom Jones. Tom was represented as a typical American GI, friendly and easygoing by nature, with a keen sense of fair play and a deep-rooted love of justice. Because he grew up in the Green Bay area of Wisconsin among a large German population, it was explained, Tom had learned to speak German in his youth. He spoke in the open and candid manner which many Europeans used to associate with Americans before their liberation or occupation. His broadcasts ended with a joke, usually a gemütlich little story with a comical aspect, but invariably with a moral lesson. Richard F. Hanser, the psych war broadcaster who played the role of Tom Jones, has responded to this writer's questionnaire with the following description. The originality lay in creating a simple homey character talking to the enemy as man to man, not as merely a disembodied voice representing the U.S. Army or the U.S. government. Tom was designed to create a recognizable personality to which listeners could respond with some warmth and interest, and in this we evidently succeeded. Tom spoke with an atrocious American accent, which was all to the good. There was no suspicion that he was a German-born turncoat. He told human interest anecdotes in a simple and even naive way, which left him free of the taint of cleverness, sharp dealing, or underhanded needling. Tom Jones is real sincere, except that he's not even real. This book is full of examples of psych war telling lies and starting rumors, because that's what psych warfare does. Now let's read where Professor David Hackett tells us that the first two Americans to enter Buchenwald on April 11th were probably Egon W. Fleck, a civilian, and First Lieutenant Edward A. Tenenbaum, intelligence officers assigned to the Publicity and Psychological Warfare Unit of the 12th Army Group Headquarters. The first two Americans to enter Buchenwald worked for psych warfare. If you had this book, Psych War, after reading about that sincere guy, Corporal Tom Jones, you could go to the back, to the list of psych warfare personnel, and read Egon Fleck, first American to enter Buchenwald. Why in the world would psych warfare be the first to enter Buchenwald? I'll tell you why. So they could plant objects, like two shrunken heads and tattooed skin, as part of a plan which involved making a short film directed by Billy Wilder. But there was another totally separate component of the psych warfare operation, a lengthy written documentation of the camp. David Hackett's introduction to this documentation tells us that the person in charge of documenting Buchenwald wasn't just a member of psych warfare, but was a German-Jewish member of psych warfare, which might create some conflict of interest objectivity issues. Hackett writes that Albert G. Rosenberg was born into a well-to-do German-Jewish family in Göttingen and had attended the University of Göttingen before emigrating to the United States in 1938. He enlisted in the army and was lucky to get into psych warfare, where there is no chance of getting killed in battle. Near the end of the war, he and his psych warfare team were in charge of managing a project that involved choosing a dozen inmates to write a 400-page documentation of Buchenwald. There's a picture of Rosenberg's team in the book Psych War under the cheeky title Kampfgruppe Rosenberg, which means Battle Group Rosenberg. Rosenberg isn't in the picture, though. In Psych War, we read, every member of the team either was born in the German-speaking area of Europe or was brought there at a comparatively early age. The report which they had the inmates create was written in German but never published. 50 years later, Professor David Hackett translated this documentation into English and added an introduction and footnotes, which is this book, The Buchenwald Report. Although it was never published back then, the top Buchenwald inmate who worked under Albert G. Rosenberg to create it, Eugen Kagan, was commissioned to rework it into a readable paperback book for the German population. Rosenberg confiscated a German house, which he then gave to Kagan so he could live there and write the new manuscript. The house was conveniently located just 2 miles from the new Psych Warfare Department headquarters, which had now changed its name to Information Control. Here's what Professor David Hackett says about Kagan's book called Der SS-Staat. His book will no doubt be a lasting legacy. As the first major study, it directly and indirectly influenced all later literature on Nazism, the SS, concentration camps, and the Holocaust. It is still one of the most frequently cited works in the field. To summarize, the Buchenwald psych warfare operation made history, emphasis on made. Besides the significant media coverage, two pieces of media came out of it, a book written by Eugen Kagan and a short movie directed by Billy Wilder. A propaganda film is made under the guise of making a documentary. It shows how 1,000 people from the nearby city of Weimar are led into the Buchenwald camp in order to show them what the Nazis have done via the table. The film will portray the Germans as walking to the camp smiling, but after they are shown the table items, they leave the camp crying and shocked. What the Weimar citizens really think is irrelevant. They are essentially extras in the movie. For instance, this blonde woman looking at the lamp may be shaking her head in disbelief. These women wonder why the camera is on them. The people have just had their city taken over by a foreign army, which is now forcing them to walk 4 miles to Buchenwald. They couldn't be happy. However, the film crew needs a shot of the crowd smiling, so they say something or do something in a Jeep driving by to get that, though not all of them fall for it.
~1200 civilians walked from the neighboring city of Weimar to begin a forced tour of the camp. There are many smiling faces, and according to observers, at first the Germans act as though this was something being staged for their benefit.
The psych warfare goal of the film is to instill guilt and shame into the German population in order to denazify them. Previous to seeing this camp, these citizens of the city of Weimar had a sense of righteous indignation because the Nazi government had told them that the Americans and British deliberately bombed residential housing, killing hundreds of thousands of women, children, teenagers, babies, and old people. It was, unfortunately, true. Psych warfare needs to take away their victim status mentality by convincing them that the Nazis did something worse. As the cameras are rolling, the German citizens of Weimar are told to gather around the table. A reporter from the New York Times is also there. His front page article will be titled, "Nazi Death Factory Shocks Germans on a Forced Tour." In the article we read, "The visitors stood in lines, one group at a time passing by the table on which the exhibits were displayed. A German-speaking American sergeant explained from an adjacent Jeep what they were witnessing, while all around them were thousands of liberated slaves just looking on. Even the barracks roof was crowded with them. Here are the inmates surrounding the Germans." Someone is holding up a human pelvis, telling the people it's a human pelvis ashtray. It's another problematic prop. For instance, as a bone, I'm not really sure if a human pelvis really lends itself to being an ashtray so well. Secondly, if you do a Google book search on the 400-page Buchenwald report written by the inmates themselves, you won't find anyone mentioning a human pelvis ashtray. Third, if the pelvis came from a cremation oven, it would have ash on it from that, but not cigarette ash. Thus, cigarette ash needs to be preserved on it for evidence, but holding it up to the crowd like this will scatter any ashes it may have had on it. Also, I'm not seeing dark ash stains against white bone. And the alleged human pelvis ashtray disappeared after its presentation here, just like the other problematic props. We freeze the footage and look in the background. This hat isn't any old hat. It's a general's helmet. It has one star, meaning that he's a one-star general, in the same way that in different footage we see General Patton has 3 stars, and General Bradley has 4 stars. This general is likely the chief of Allied psych warfare, a one-star general named Robert A. McClure, a photo of whom we find in the book Psych War. And here's McClure with his direct supervisor, Eisenhower. Compare the facial line at the side of the mouth. And guess who the guy is who held up the human pelvis ashtray? C.D. Jackson, his deputy. Remember the name C.D. Jackson. Fast forward 16 years. If you're good at putting forth a hoax with your psychological propaganda skills, should it follow as a natural progression that you end up as publisher of Life magazine? Because what it kind of looks like is that you're using your psychological propaganda skills to manipulate the American people. And one moment you're holding up a human pelvis ashtray to a crowd, and the next moment you're hanging out with General Eisenhower on the presidential campaign trail. Eisenhower opens Jersey tour today, arrives here to begin two-day bid, first in the state by a GOP nominee since 1940. The aides included C.D. Jackson, editor of Fortune magazine. Then Eisenhower gets elected president, and we read, Eisenhower picks a Cold War chief. Names C.D. Jackson, New York publisher, in move to spur psychological operations. Eisenhower hasn't even been president for a month, and he's got Jackson on board as his special assistant. That's because Jackson and McClure helped create the Holocaust myth, without which Eisenhower could not have been elected president. 3 months later, C.D. Jackson is on board the presidential yacht. President Eisenhower returned to the Capitol today after what he described as a grand ride on the yacht Williamsburg, on which he had cruised to Williamsburg, Virginia. During the weekend cruise, the president worked on the report to the nation he will make by radio at 10:30 p.m. tomorrow. He was aided by C.D. Jackson, an expert in psychological and media manipulation, helping to write a speech for the American people. Here's some charts in the book Psych War showing how McClure, Jackson, and Eisenhower are connected. While McClure and Jackson set up their psychological warfare operation at Buchenwald, Eisenhower did his part to actively promote it. In David Hackett's book, we read, "But it is clear that Eisenhower was the essential catalyst in organizing the publicity barrage." Down the page, we read, "Eisenhower was still so disturbed by what he had seen that the atrocities again became the major topic of conversation when he met Prime Minister Churchill in London a few days later. Eisenhower spent a long evening with Churchill discussing the state of the war and visited him the next morning at the annex to 10 Downing Street, the war rooms. Eisenhower promised to send photos of the camps to Churchill, who apparently shared his outrage. He urged Churchill to send a group of members of parliament and journalists to tour the camps at once. An American delegation, Eisenhower feared, might be too late to see the full horrors, whereas an English delegation, being so much closer, could get there on time." In short, Eisenhower made sure disinformation entered the American and British media. General McClure stayed on after the war as head of Info Control. This article tells us about a letter he wrote. The Information Control Department had a wide-ranging charter. Indeed, as McClure wrote to his friend and vice president of Time Life Incorporated, C.D. Jackson, in July 1946, "We now control 37 newspapers, 6 radio stations, 314 theaters, 642 movies, 101 magazines, 237 book publishers, 7,384 book dealers and printers, and conduct about 15 public opinion surveys a month, as well as publish one newspaper with a 1.5 million circulation, 3 magazines, run the Associated Press of Germany, DANA, and operate 20 library centers. The job is tremendous. When he said 642 movies, he meant 642 movie theaters, where the Buchenwald propaganda film can be shown. McClure and Jackson both have media power, but who's just below? It's William Paley, owner of CBS Radio Network and later CBS Television Network. It's like Edward Herman and Noam Chomsky's book, Manufacturing Consent, except it's Manufacturing Con. Every American down there likely believes the Holocaust is a historic fact, and if you were to ask them to give a reason why, they'd probably be taken aback by such a request. But when they thought about it for a moment, the main evidence they would offer is the piles of bodies which American troops found when they liberated the camps. We'll show that the reason Americans believe the piles of bodies are the biggest evidence for the Holocaust is because of Dwight D. Eisenhower. Then we'll show why the piles of bodies are not evidence for the Holocaust at all. First, some excerpts about Eisenhower at a camp.
As they moved into the final weeks of the war in Europe, Allied soldiers were sickened and infuriated to discover Nazi concentration camps in which millions had been murdered or starved to death. Appalled at these sadistic revelations, Eisenhower quickly exposed the grim sights to the world. George Patton himself forced German civilians to look upon the gut-wrenching, heartbreaking scenes.
The footage showed Eisenhower at the Ohrdruf camp, which is the first camp the Americans discovered. It was found 7 days before Buchenwald was liberated. We look up Ohrdruf at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum and read, "When the soldiers of the 4th Armored Division entered the camp, they discovered piles of bodies, some covered with lime,
they see the woodshed where lime-covered bodies are stacked in layers and the stench is overpowering."
Same pile from a different angle. And others partially incinerated on pyres.
The general and his party next see the crude woodland crematory, actually a grill made of railway tracks. Here, the bodies of victims were cremated. Charred remains of several inmates still lay heaped atop the grill.
The ghastly nature of their discovery led General Dwight D. Eisenhower, Supreme Commander of the Allied Forces in Europe, to visit the camp on April 12th.
"The murder mill at Ohrdruf brings out the full horror and bestiality of the Nazi scum. And General Eisenhower, a man hardened by the blood and shock of war, seems appalled at these unbelievable sights." Accompanied by General Bradley on his revolting mission, and also by General Patton, hard-boiled yet visibly moved, the Supreme Commander sees demonstrations of the torture racks.
After his visit, Eisenhower cabled General George C. Marshall, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, describing his trip to Ohrdruf. "The most interesting, although horrible, sight that I encountered during the trip was a visit to a German internment camp near Gotha. The things I saw beggar description. While I was touring the camp, I encountered three men who had been inmates and by one ruse or another had made their escape. I interviewed them through an interpreter. The visual evidence and the verbal testimony of starvation, cruelty, and bestiality were so overpowering as to leave me a bit sick. In one room where they were piled up 20 or 30 naked men, killed by starvation, George Patton would not even enter. He said that he would get sick if he did so. I made the visit deliberately in order to be in a position to give first-hand evidence of these things if ever, in the future, there develops a tendency to charge these allegations merely to propaganda." The article ends by stating, The 4th Armored Division's discovery of the Ohrdruf camp opened the eyes of many American soldiers to the horrors perpetrated by the Nazis during the Holocaust. Raoul Hilberg was the world's most prominent Holocaust historian.
Therefore, to address these things which are minutiae or detail, in order that I might then be able to put together in a gestalt a picture which, if not an explanation, is at least a description, a more full description of what transpired.
And his three-volume work, The Destruction of the European Jews, is considered the standard work on the Holocaust. So what did Hilberg say about Ohrdruf, the camp Eisenhower visited? Nothing. It didn't make it into the 1,231 pages of his book. On page 1219, we see a table of deaths by cause. There are the main camps where the killing supposedly happened. They were all taken by the Soviet Union. Ohrdruf, the camp Eisenhower visited, doesn't make the table. The main camp where piles of bodies were found by the Allies was Bergen-Belsen. A very distant second was Dachau. They are in the category of camps in the low tens of thousands or below, a category that is only 3% of the Holocaust. There are no photos of stacks of bodies for these camps where the Holocaust mainly occurred. Then on page 980 we read, in November 1944, Himmler decided that for practical purposes, the Jewish question had been solved. On the 25th of that month, he ordered the dismantling of the killing installations. This passage is problematic for the widely believed notion that Eisenhower is seeing evidence of the Nazis caught red-handed exterminating Jews. Because Eisenhower is at Ohrdruf in April 1945, which is 5 months after Himmler supposedly ordered the dismantling of the killing installations. For Americans, the biggest evidence for the Holocaust are the piles of bodies. That's problematic because shouldn't the main evidence for the Holocaust be from where the Holocaust occurred? Americans are positive the Holocaust happened for the wrong reasons. As an aside, my first video was about these three camps where the Holocaust did greatly occur. That video shows beyond a reasonable doubt that these three camps were not death camps. Understanding the piles of bodies. When you see the piles of bodies at Ohrdruf and other camps, what you're seeing is not the Nazis murdering Jews up until the last moment and then being caught red-handed by the Allies. The following 8 points explain why. Number 1. Typhus. Because typhus barely exists today, it's hard to grasp what it was historically. It was a disease spread by lice, which creates a high fever, and it killed most people who got it in the camps. Today, lice simply equals an itchy scalp, but back then the typhus bacteria would be in lice feces, which a person would scratch into microscopic cuts in their skin, thereby giving them typhus. The bacteria eventually kills the louse as well. The dead bodies here are probably mostly typhus victims dragged out of barracks so that the existing lice or lice soon to be hatched from eggs won't crawl onto other people. And Eisenhower would have known that. He's playing dumb.
Those selected to be gassed were told they would be de-loused in the showers before starting work. Then they would rejoin their families.
As an aside, typhus is key to understanding the entire Holocaust myth, because in the myth, delousing chambers become gas chambers, and in the myth, insecticide becomes poison gas. A tiny bacteria inside the poop of a louse is key to understanding the world's biggest lie. Number 2. Other diseases. Typhus wasn't the only disease in the camps. At Belsen, where the largest number of dead bodies was found by far, typhoid was also present, which one gets from contaminated water. and nearly everyone at Belsen had chronic diarrhea. Typhoid and chronic diarrhea make people lose a lot of weight. Many inmates had multiple diseases at the same time. Number 3, quarantine.
All occupied Europe had a concentration camp system based on the model camp, Dachau. The camps were not only an instrument of terror. They were an important factor in war production, each with its cluster of labor camps attached. Now, they were also to be the means of the final solution. In the occupied East, new camps were specially built, and old ones equipped with new industrial capacity. They were to be machines to kill human beings by the million, utilize the byproducts, dispose of the waste. The camps were sited on railway routes to facilitate transportation. Eichmann chartered rolling stock from the state railways. The biggest camp of all was built astride the main railway line from Krakow to Vienna, in the outskirts of the Polish town of Oświęcim, Auschwitz.
What a bunch of baloney. This is a labor camp system, and when you know that, suddenly the blue dots everywhere make a lot more sense, because those were factories and areas where work was done, in addition to factories that were inside the premises of the main camps, represented by the larger dots. With Germany nearly defeated, the United States and Britain helped pave the way for the Soviet army by wiping out entire East German cities with bombing raids, such as Dresden around right here.
Next day came the Americans. A Western demonstration of support for the Russians now less than 100 miles away. Over 1,300 flying fortresses to pound the ruins of a city.
In the Times Atlas of the Second World War, we read that 3 hours after the first wave of bombing, a second wave of bombing begins. 529 Lancaster bombers timed to disrupt emergency relief convoys from surrounding towns. In other words, to kill the firemen and medical workers who responded to the first wave of bombing. Because most of the bombs were fire bombs, the brick and steel structures still stand.
Industrial damage was slight. The railway was working again in 3 days. But over 100,000 died. Dresden was another monument to total war.
The humanitarian disaster caused by this type of bombing, combined with refugees fleeing the advancing Soviet army, combined with a breakdown of the German infrastructure, is making the camp system unable to keep diseases at bay. The Germans are not confident that the incoming Soviet army is going to be able to control the diseases and quarantine the camps. And if inmates walk out of the camps, a typhus epidemic could engulf this entire region. Ben Shepherd writes that typhus had killed 3 million people in Russia at the end of the First World War, and the German government is trying to prevent a similar epidemic at the end of World War II. But meanwhile, the German government is also starting to collapse. So they try to evacuate these camps and send the inmates into camps the Americans and British will take over. The Germans moved Jews from Auschwitz all the way across Europe to Bergen-Belsen here. This fact doesn't fit the Holocaust story at all. As a result, the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum has to spin it as a death march. And it was a dangerous trip, what with U.S. airmen being given orders to shoot anything that moves, including this German man being pulled by a horse. And the Germans were successful in preventing epidemics in East Germany and Poland. However, they lost control of the diseases inside the camps, particularly at Belsen. We go to the book After Daybreak and find that Belsen became overcrowded very quick, which aided the spread of lice and diseases. It didn't have enough food and, as Ben Shepherd writes, Allied bombing nearby disrupted the water supply, which kept people from staying clean and keeping the lice off them. Belsen thus became a biological disaster. The photos of Belsen and footage then become the biggest reason for the world to believe the Holocaust happened. Starvation happened in the camps only in the last months of the war, but Eisenhower wants the public to believe that starvation was one of the normal practices of the Germans in these camps. Eisenhower wants everyone to think that the condition of the camps as the Allies found them was the same condition as they had always been. Eisenhower's spin then reverberates into what educated Americans believe today, that one way the Germans tried to kill Jews was by slowly starving them to death while overworking them in factories. But consider why this is muddled thinking. The German troops are relying on these factories for support. Starvation creates lethargy and spacey-headedness, not good traits for someone building aircraft or bombs. The Germans would have managed their labor pool in a smart way that best supported their troops. Both books confirm that starvation in the camps only happened in the last months of the war. In the Buchenwald Report, a former inmate writes a section called The Food Supply and gives a breakdown of food rationing. He writes that a year before the camp was liberated, the camp food rations were about equal to the basic rations for the civilian population. Equal to the civilian population. In general, the food rations for camp inmates remained constant up to February 1945. That's 2 months before the end of the war. With the flood of soldiers returning from the east and the evacuation of the eastern camps and the German civilian population, food rations for the camp inmates were radically reduced. For 10 months, food rations at Buchenwald were equal to food rations in the German civilian population. Because of Eisenhower's legacy of concentration camp disinformation, most Americans would not believe that if you told them. The food supply in the camps was related to the food supply in Germany. And there was a food shortage in Germany near the end of the war due to a number of factors. 1. An Allied food blockade. 2. The German government infrastructure beginning to collapse at the end of the war. 3. Allied bombing of trains needed to transport food. And 4. Millions of refugees fleeing the advancing Soviet army who also needed to be fed. But regarding starvation in Europe during World War II, let's consider whether the USA and Britain bear any responsibility. In a footnote in the book After Daybreak by Ben Shepherd, we read, many of the major charities in Britain had other preoccupations, most notably with the consequences of the Allied policy of blockade, which prevented food aid from reaching German-occupied Europe, in the mistaken belief that, by letting millions of Europeans starve, the German war economy would be weakened. Oxfam, the Oxford Committee for Famine Relief, was founded in 1942, especially to lobby the British government to change its blockade policy, but, although an exception was made in the case of Greece, after some 500,000 Greeks had died of starvation, Churchill and his ministers refused to change tack. 500,000 Greeks died of starvation? That's 10 times more than what the Allies found in the concentration camps. Why have I never heard of that before? For some reason, British and American World War II TV shows never informed their viewers about British and American caused starvation deaths. 2 years before this footage of Ohrdruf was taken, there was a famine in the British Empire that killed 2.5 million people. The United States offered no help. It's hard to find a single photo of the Bengal famine. One finds a sketch. To see one of the many causes of it, we read in Ben Shepherd's book. It then turned out that Churchill's decision earlier in the year to divert shipping from the Indian Ocean to the Mediterranean in order to attack Italy, had removed much of the transport needed to bring relief supplies from abroad. The USA and Britain are responsible for way more starvation deaths than starvation deaths that happened in the Nazi camps. Number 5. Fake emotion of shock. Eisenhower, Bradley, and Patton have been involved with causing millions of deaths during World War II. That they are shocked by 100 bodies here at Ordruff is not believable. Ordruff is the first camp found by the Americans, so it becomes the showcase camp for propaganda. That's because the Allies don't know they are going to find an infinitely worse camp called Belsen in a number of days. Eisenhower and his psych warfare team picked the wrong camp to showcase, which helps us to see what their motivations were in the first place. Eisenhower is walking by this pile. Now look how small the grill is.
The general and his party next see the crude woodland crematory, actually a grill made of railway tracks. Here, the bodies of victims were cremated. Charred remains of several inmates still lay heaped atop the grill.
So with 100 bodies lying around, Eisenhower plays dumb and pretends he's never heard of typhus. An easy thing to do since the Americans have a typhus vaccine and the Germans do not. An easy thing to do since the Americans know that DDT kills lice and the Germans do not. Let's read two passages about this from Ben Shepherd's book. But the real breakthrough in treating typhus was made when the Americans came up with three new weapons. The Cox vaccine, developed at the Rockefeller Institute in New York in 1940, the insecticide DDT, and the mechanical dust gun. Dichloral diphenyl trichloroethane, first synthesized by a German chemist in 1874, had only recently been revealed as an efficient pesticide when used on Colorado beetles, threatening the potato crop in Switzerland in 1939. On the next page, page 77, we read, typhus, more dreaded than bullets in any army, is now simply unknown among our soldiers and sailors, the New York Times wrote in 1944. DDT seems almost too good to be true. Typhus was a huge issue for the Germans and a non-issue for the Americans. Eisenhower took advantage of that discrepancy to fabricate the Holocaust myth. Then Eisenhower promotes the camps in a major way. We read on the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum's website that after Eisenhower visited Ordruff, he cabled General George C. Marshall, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in Washington, and asked, if you could see any advantage in asking about a dozen leaders of Congress and a dozen prominent editors to make a short visit to this theater in a couple of C-54s, I will arrange to have them conducted to one of these places where the evidence of bestiality and cruelty is so overpowering as to leave no doubt in their minds about the normal practices of the Germans in these camps. Eisenhower is going to send U.S. congressmen and newspaper editors to Buchenwald, where they will see shrunken heads, tattooed skin, and lampshades. Eisenhower won't tell them that these items were planted by psych warfare in an operation he knows about. Here is an organization chart in the book Psych War. As you can see, the head of psych warfare, Robert McClure, answers directly to Eisenhower.
American congressmen invited to view the atrocities were told by General Eisenhower, nothing is covered up. We have nothing to conceal. The barbarous treatment these people received in the German concentration camps is almost unbelievable. I want you to see for yourselves and be the spokesman for the United States.
Eisenhower knows that popularity for the war means popularity for him. That popularity will take him all the way to President of the United States. The war started over the German invasion of Poland. It's now the end of the war, and Poland is not liberated. It's occupied by the Soviet Union under Joseph Stalin, along with half of Europe. The war brought so much death and destruction, and since the reasons it started are not resolved, there now needs to be a retroactive reason to justify it. The retroactive reason is the great myth known as the Holocaust. World War II then becomes a justifier for all future wars.
I just want to also say that Congressman Paul, I've heard him now in many debates talking about bringing our troops home and about the war in Iraq and how it's failed. And I want to tell you that that kind of isolationism, sir, is what caused World War II. We allowed Hitler to come to power with that kind of attitude of isolationism and appeasement.
Okay.
And I want to tell you something, sir. I just finished having Thanksgiving with the troops, and their message to you is, the message of these brave men and women who are serving over there is, let us win. Let us win.
Right.
That's what they want.
Please.
People's thinking wants to evolve beyond war, but the great myth as a postulate of thinking gets in the way. Number 6, Ohrdruf was probably only one-fifth Jewish. Eisenhower is at Ohrdruf, which we read is a subcamp of the Buchenwald concentration camp. We saw in David Hackett's introduction to the Buchenwald report that Buchenwald, when liberated, was around one-fifth Jewish. Ohrdruf, as a subcamp, probably had a similar percentage. So out of the 100 bodies found, maybe 20 are Jewish. 20 Jewish bodies could not be major evidence for the Holocaust, but Eisenhower would have you believe it is. To see this, we go to Eisenhower's own book, Crusade in Europe. That same day, I saw my first horror camp. It was near the town of Gotha. Ohrdruf is the only camp near Gotha. I have never felt able to describe my emotional reactions when I first came face to face with indisputable evidence of Nazi brutality and ruthless disregard of every shred of decency. Up to that time, I had known about it only generally or through secondary sources. I am certain, however, that I have never at any other time experienced an equal sense of shock. I visited every nook and cranny of the camp because I felt it my duty to be in a position from then on to testify at first hand about these things in case there ever grew up at home the belief or assumption that the stories of Nazi brutality were just propaganda. Some members of the visiting party were unable to go through the ordeal. I not only did so, but as soon as I returned to Patton's headquarters that evening, I sent communications to both Washington and London, urging the two governments to send instantly to Germany a random group of newspaper editors and representative groups from the national legislatures. I felt that the evidence should be immediately placed before the American and British publics in a fashion that would leave no room for cynical doubt. The standard Holocaust story was not firmed up yet in April 1945. When it was, Ohrdruf wasn't part of it. Eisenhower is trying to create the hoax in the wrong place, but fixes this soon after by sending congressmen and newspaper editors not to Ohrdruf but to Buchenwald instead, where Eisenhower's psych warfare unit has prepared a table for them. Eisenhower's large book came out 3 years after the war, and the passage we read is all there is on the Holocaust, as can be verified by doing a Google book search. So why can't Eisenhower discuss the Holocaust in an articulate, specific, and intelligent way? Because acting shocked and playing dumb covers that this intelligent man is one of the creators of the hoax, and by writing about it vaguely with just what he saw at Ordruff, he covers himself in case the hoax breaks in the late 40s or 1950s, which it did not. The shoddiness of the Ordruff investigation can be glimpsed by looking at who their tour guide was. He had been a Dutch inmate in the camp. Here he is demonstrating the whipping block. He's probably telling them what they want to hear as a survival strategy. He's hanging out with Eisenhower, Patton, and Bradley, but in the surreal absurdity of war, he'll be dead by tomorrow. George Patton writes of him, "It later developed that he was not a prisoner at all, but one of the executioners. General Eisenhower must have suspected it, because he asked the man very pointedly how he could be so fat. He was found dead next morning, killed by some of the inmates." He was probably an inmate foreman known as a capo, killed by the prisoners he used to manage. Even if you believe the standard Holocaust story, which I do not, inmates were never executioners. The bodies at Ordruff are terrible, but let's put it in perspective with the bombing of Nuremberg by the British 3 months earlier. 1,800 people died in the medieval ruins of what was a symbolic but not a military target. And Nuremberg brings up a dirty trick that goes beyond anything Dick Nixon ever did. This shrunken head planted at Buchenwald by Eisenhower's psych warfare people was sent to the Nuremberg trial and used as part of the evidence to get 10 men executed. Shown here is U.S. Prosecutor Thomas J. Dodd. Let's hear him in the Nuremberg courtroom.
This exhibit, which is on the table, is a human head with the skull bone removed, shrunken, stuffed, and preserved. The Nazis had one of their many victims decapitated after having had him hanged, apparently for fraternizing with a German woman, and fashioned this terrible ornament from his head.
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist.
Eisenhower's farewell address, warning about the military-industrial complex, was a popularity coup for his legacy, an outgoing popularity coup by someone who had staged an incoming popularity coup. And why didn't Eisenhower warn about the media industry complex? After all, what people see on TV has a lot more to do with creating war than McDonnell Douglas. It should be called the substitution speech.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators.
Because the Holocaust myth never broke, the American public never learned to be skeptical of stories which justify war.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
This is 1990, before the first Gulf War. Do you, the viewer watching this, notice anything odd about her testimony? I'll give you 5 seconds to say out loud what it is. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. She speaks perfect American English.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns.
What are the chances of a 15-year-old girl who speaks perfect American English with no accent being in a Middle Eastern neonatal intensive care unit when Iraqi soldiers come in? Listen again. There's no accent, and Valley Girl doesn't count.
While I was there, I saw the Iraqi soldiers come into the hospital with guns. They took the babies out of the incubators. Took the incubators and left the children to die on the cold floor.
And they had kids in incubators, and they were thrown out of the incubators so that Kuwait could be systematically dismantled.
This shows a phenomenon where people take off their thinking caps when presented with a terrible story which justifies war. And this phenomenon has been a major strength of the Holocaust myth. Another major strength of the Holocaust myth is the belief that Holocaust deniers must have ulterior motives, basic hate, anti-Semitism, white supremacism, that they want a Holocaust to happen. How about anti-war? The Holocaust myth is part and parcel with babies on life support, with weapons of mass destruction, and with the Gulf of Tonkin incident. These myths would not have flown if this myth had broke in the late 1940s or 1950s.
The circle is now complete. When I left you, I was but the learner. Now I am the master.
Only a master of evil, God.
We see two really wrong concepts. One, that there's good guys and bad guys. And from that, two, that good fights evil with weapons. The real deal is that it's all about understanding people. These two concepts are more about justifying an evolutionary desire for macho posturing, which can come off in a very Baby Huey sort of way.
I've been invited to Fort Sill for an exclusive preview of America's latest howitzer, the M777.
These two concepts are more about justifying an evolutionary desire to fight.
Since the beginning of time, the concept of the infantry soldier pretty much hasn't changed. He's issued a weapon, armor. If he's lucky, he gets a helmet. While the concept hasn't changed, it has evolved. Meet Land Warrior. It puts state-of-the-art technology right onto the soldier's body.
Star Wars ends with a precision bombing attack that creates a giant explosion. How is this justified? By a dumb-dumb portrayal of evil.
Not after we demonstrate the power of this station. In a way, you had determined the choice of the planet that will be destroyed first.
No, but Alderaan is peaceful. We have no weapons. You can't...
Are you all right? What's wrong?
I felt a great disturbance in the force, as if millions of voices suddenly cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced.
People's thinking wants to evolve beyond good guys and bad guys, and beyond good fighting evil with weapons. But the Holocaust, as a postulate in their thinking, gets in the way.
The United States is the greatest force for good in the world. And we have not an obligation to go out and fight and start wars, but to certainly do everything we can to spread democracy and freedom throughout the world.
Number 7. Bodies left out for 8 days. We are told that America's top generals felt ill when they toured the Ordruff labor camp. But what's never mentioned is that the Americans have left the bodies out for 8 days by the time Eisenhower arrives. These generals have seen lots of dead bodies. It's more likely that the smell is what's making them sick. In the book Inside the Vicious Heart, Americans and the Liberation of Nazi Concentration Camps, by Professor Robert Abzug, we read, Patton retired behind a barracks and became physically ill. And Eisenhower wrote, The visual evidence and the verbal testimony of starvation, cruelty, and bestiality were so overpowering as to leave me a bit sick. Omar Bradley wrote, The smell of death overwhelmed us even before we passed the stockade. But now let's look at the dates. Abzug's book, Inside the Vicious Heart, tells us, Ohrdruf had actually been discovered by accident on April 4th or 5th. And at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum website, we read that Eisenhower, Bradley, and Patton visited the camp on April 12th. That's 8 days later. Try leaving a piece of meat out on your kitchen counter for 8 days. It will smell up your whole house. And we get an insight into how they died when we see that General Bradley wrote, Lice crawled over the yellowed skin of their sharp, bony frames. That means they probably died from typhus and were dragged out of the barracks so that lice wouldn't get on others. The bodies will be left out for a whole month because Eisenhower needs them to justify World War II, which some American soldiers know has been a disaster for Europe. We see this in Robert Abzug's book. Soon after seeing Ohrdruf, Eisenhower ordered every unit nearby that was not in the front lines to tour Ohrdruf. We are told that the American soldier does not know what he is fighting for. Now, at least, he will know what he is fighting against. At the website scrapbookpages.com, which has an Ohrdruf section, we see a photo with the caption, In May 1945, this U.S. soldier posed with bodies left out since April 2, 1945. This could be an American soldier who, years later, perhaps in the 1970s, at a gathering of relatives, if, say, his nephew expressed some doubt about something about the Holocaust, this soldier in the photo could pull the ultimate trump card in that conversation, replying, I was there. I went into one of the concentration camps and saw the bodies stacked up like cordwood. Don't tell me the Holocaust didn't happen. I saw it with my own eyes. Number 8. Death from a meal. When 1,000 Germans from the city of Weimar took a forced tour of the Buchenwald concentration camp, they were made to walk between two piles of dead bodies. But what they were not told is that it was the Americans who likely killed these inmates, not the Nazis. They were killed unintentionally with a large meal given to them by the Americans. Psych warfare then stepped in and framed the SS for killing them by stacking up their bodies for use in their propaganda film. Is it really possible to be killed from a meal? To answer this, we look at an English medical journal called The Lancet and read about the Belsen concentration camp, which was liberated a couple days after Buchenwald. With long-standing starvation, the body had become adapted to low intake of food and water, and the digestive system did not tolerate rapid increase of diet, especially if it contained much fat. Liberal feeding with rich foods, such as were supplied with well-meant but mistaken kindness by fighting units when the camp was first uncovered, or even by injudicious dieting in hospital, caused abdominal pain and vomiting, and precipitated or exacerbated diarrhea, sometimes with fatal results. But the author's subtlety doesn't reveal the extent of this disaster. To get that, we go to the definitive work on Belsen called After Daybreak by Ben Shepherd. They started to give us pork tins. I never forget that, Edith Fuchs, a Czech Jewess, later recalled. It was like corned beef, but it was pork with a lot of fat in it. Heidi Schmuck, the young woman from Transylvania, remembered, tins of ham, baked beans, thick soups, rich, heavy food, good for soldiers. Sarah Bick, another survivor, had memories of cans of beans, honey, syrup, evaporated milk. Those who got the food wolfed it down. Shepherd ends the chapter by writing, it was later estimated that some 2,000 people perished as a result of being given the wrong food. The British had made their first big mistake. Death from a meal happened at Buchenwald also. David Hackett's introduction to the Buchenwald report tells us, feeding the prisoners became the most urgent task of the occupying American forces. Soon after liberation, abundant quantities of food requisitioned from nearby Weimar were made available to the camp inmates. But on receiving the food, the severely malnourished prisoners developed gastrointestinal problems, and many died. Starving people have the desire to eat a lot of food, but if they are allowed to do so, their first big meal can kill them. Hackett's book then tells us that the camp population dropped by 1,000 after the Americans took over. We read, on April 16, 1945, a count of the camp population showed a total of 20,000, about 1,000 fewer inmates than were counted on the day of liberation. April 16th was the day the propaganda film was shot, and 5 days earlier was the day of liberation. The biggest cause of population loss was likely death from a meal, but let's rule out some other possibilities. Did 1,000 inmates simply leave the camp? Probably not, because we read in Hackett's introduction, with more than 3 weeks before Victory in Europe Day, most prisoners had to be kept in camp for a time before they could safely return to their homes. Also, the Allies would have wanted to dust all the inmates with DDT before letting them leave. Did 1,000 inmates die of typhus? Typhus was a major cause of death at Belsen, but not at Buchenwald. We see this in David Hackett's introduction to the Buchenwald report. The U.S. Army Medical Corps prevented a massive outbreak of typhus by quickly launching a decontamination campaign using DDT. At that point, 62 cases of typhus had already been diagnosed but were isolated in a hospital ward. And under American care, some of these 62 people would have survived. Typhus can only account for a small number of the population drop of 1,000 inmates. Were dead bodies already there when the Americans arrived? Probably not. That was the situation at Belsen and Ohrdruf, but probably not at Buchenwald. To see this, we look at what happened on April 11, 1945. In the morning, the Nazi SS commander wakes up in the camp. He and the remaining SS depart from Buchenwald around noon. By 5:30 p.m., two American officers from Allied psych warfare show up. In other words, they arrive just hours after the SS commander has evacuated. David Hackett's book tells us that the psych warfare officers stayed long enough to gather material for an 18-page preliminary report that included a short history of the camp. Hackett then writes, the two psych warfare officers could not help being impressed that, instead of a heap of corpses or a disorderly mob of starving, leaderless men, the Americans found a disciplined and efficient organization in Buchenwald. So apparently, at Buchenwald, unlike other camps, there were not dead bodies lying around. If we go to Robert Abzug's book, Inside the Vicious Heart, we find that he also mentions Psych Warfare's 18-page preliminary report. But with a curious detail, Abzug tells us it was a secret report. Why would the first two Americans to enter Buchenwald write a secret report? After all, The war will be over in 3 weeks, so why should the first American report on a concentration camp be secret? The answer is this. Psych warfare needed to know the real situation in the camp in order to help them put forth a fake situation. And that's also the reason why psych warfare got there just hours after the Nazis left. Regarding how these piles of bodies came about, we go to the website of Holy Cross College in Massachusetts, USA. In the History Department section, we see photos of the bodies being stacked as American troops in the background look on. This tells us that the piles were created by the Americans after the Nazis left.
The camps were overrun. Many Germans had known of them. Others had preferred not to know. Now they were forced to see.
Billy Wilder's propaganda film includes a close-up pan across the dead bodies in this wagon, and around 30 years later, millions of viewers in 87 countries watched this footage in the World at War television series.
This is Buchenwald.
But what the millions of viewers in 1974 didn't know is that these inmates were likely alive when the Nazis left the camp. They heard the cheers when the American soldiers arrived. They spoke broken English to an American soldier named Mike, Steve, or Dave. Then they were given a large meal, which killed them. Psych warfare then used their bodies to tell a lie. The items on the table are not randomly picked scary items. Most of the items were mentioned in the Pfaffenberger Affidavit, which was written 4 months before Buchenwald was liberated. Take, for example, the shrunken heads. In December 1944, Andreas Pfaffenberger wrote, "There I also saw the shrunken heads of 2 young Poles who had been hanged for having had relations with German girls. And on April 16th, there they are, just in time to be filmed for Billy Wilder's propaganda movie." Psych warfare likely planted the heads and other objects in the camp after reading about them in the Pfaffenberger Affidavit. They did it as part of their denazification program. As the head of psych warfare, Robert McClure, wrote to his wife, "The shooting war is over. With one phase over, I am now up to my neck on the control phase." The control phase was the Holocaust myth phase, the denazification phase. The Buchenwald table is just one small part of this phase. To understand what psych warfare did at Buchenwald, let's make an analogy to McDonald's. When I was 12 years old, there was a rumor that McDonald's hamburger meat had worms in it. It's probably because meat has a worm shape after it passes through a grinder. While it would be hard for someone to create a nationwide rumor like that, it would not be hard for someone to pick the back door lock of a McDonald's late at night and put some containers of worms in their freezer and then call the health department and a TV station the next day. Figuratively, that's what psych warfare did at Buchenwald. They supported existing rumors rather than create new ones. To give an idea why, let's read a passage from the book Psych War. "Despite its importance, rumor as a technique is difficult to assess because it is difficult to control. Many rumors said to be based upon psych war broadcasts, for example, bore little relation to either the content or the intention of the broadcasts from which they derived. An extended field trip over Allied-held areas of Western Germany in the month preceding surrender led one psych warfare intelligence investigator to observe that rumor mongering sometimes had unpredictable consequences. Often enough, the news spread by this method bore only a casual resemblance to the news actually announced over Allied transmitters. So instead, they decided to support existing rumors they learned about in the Pfaffenberger affidavit. But who was Andreas Pfaffenberger? He was a 43-year-old captured German soldier with a rare background. He had been an inmate at Buchenwald prior to being drafted into the German army. Pfaffenberger surrendered here 5 months before Buchenwald was liberated here. The distance is around 225 miles. Psych warfare used his statement to start planning for Buchenwald before the camp was liberated. Besides mentioning two shrunken heads, the Pfaffenberger affidavit mentions human skin lampshades, and it mentions tattooed skin. But there's a problem for psych warfare's plan. They are planting objects based on old rumors, because Pfaffenberger likely lied about how up-to-date his information was. He claimed he'd been at Buchenwald from November 1938 to June 1944, but while dropping as many names as he could, he never mentioned the name of the camp's current commander, Hermann Pister, and he'd been the commander from 1942 on, probably because Pfaffenberger had left the camp before 1942. Here's another indicator that Pfaffenberger's information was old. The camp had a position called senior prisoner, or Lageraltest, and Pfaffenberger mentions Alfred Richter as holding that position, but Richter held the position in the late 1930s. Pfaffenberger doesn't mention the men who held the position after that, probably because he'd already left by then. By using old information that they think is current, the Buchenwald table hoax becomes logically flawed. Because even if, say, atrocity items had been in the camp at one time, they wouldn't have been there after the Morgan investigation, or after Hermann Pister took over, or after Ilse Koch left, or after Karl Koch's execution. Take Karl Koch. The SS were so interested in justice that they brought this former commander back to Buchenwald just so they could execute him in the camp where he committed his crimes. It's unlikely that on the day they executed him, the current commander, Hermann Pister, would have had human skin lampshades and shrunken heads made from inmates lying around. So where did psych warfare get the objects? Probably from the same place this dissertation comes from, the University of Jena, just 10 miles away. This brings up Kenneth Kipperman. As a Jewish pre-teen, the table items made a deep impact on him when he saw them on television in the 1950s. His work might be in your wallet right now, because as an employee with the United States Bureau of Printing and Engraving, he engraved the image of Alexander Hamilton on the $10 bill. When he's not doing that, he researches the Buchenwald table items, and in a Jerusalem Post article we read about Kipperman looking at a good quality photo of the table. And next to the lamp was a report of some kind. Using his engraver's magnifying glass, Kipperman made out the German printing on the cover, tracked down its origin, and had the report, a doctoral dissertation on the sociology of tattooing, translated. The dissertation, A Contribution to the Tattooing Question, was written by Dr. Eric Wagner of the Institute of Forensic Medicine and Scientific Criminology at Friedrich Schiller University in Jena, Germany. Wagner had done research at Buchenwald around the time Pfaffenberger was there, around 1939 or 1940. Psych Warfare likely went to the university and picked up the dissertation, the tattoos, the medical oddities, and even grabbed a death mask found at the front left of the table. Plaster death masks were used to make an impression of a person's face and were popular in the days before photography. They are found in many cultures. The death mask makes sense as a piece pilfered from a university collection, but doesn't really make sense as an atrocity item. Even though Pfaffenberger really had been in Buchenwald, his affidavit is full of lies. Let's read a fraudulent passage. During his stay in Buchenwald from 1939 to 1940, Scharfuhrer Kuritz killed many Jews with a club and made many more die a horrible death in a pigsty. There the Jews, first forced to shovel off the top of a manure pile, were then made to lie down on the rest. Other prisoners were compelled to shovel the manure back on top of their comrades, after which they were forced to do exercises on top of the completed pile, while the victims buried underneath choked to death. If we do a Google book search on the Buchenwald report, we find that no other inmate mentioned this manure incident, which points to it being fraudulent. The Buchenwald report is 400 pages long. 10 inmates worked to put it together, and besides their own writings, it contains individual statements from around 140 other inmates. Yet no one else mentions the exercises on the pile of manure story. Here's another example of Pfaffenberger lying. He writes, Minister Reiter and his son-in-law died in this fashion in early 1939. The fashion was, the victims were forced to carry a load of rocks up a hill. When they had lost their strength, they were thrown on a table and beaten to a bloody pulp. The problem is, Minister Reiter is Joseph Reiter, and he was never at Buchenwald, and he survived the war. Pfaffenberger's motivation is he wants to look good to American interrogators, so he writes that he was only on active duty as a German soldier for only about a week, and writes, I managed to get hold of 20 rounds of blank ammunition in case I was actually forced to fire. In reality, he'd probably been in the German army for years and hadn't seen Buchenwald for a long time. Pfaffenberger tells us he surrendered near Seemannsskull at a cottage, and curiously enough, that very cottage is now preserved as part of a World War II historical museum on the Belgian-German border. Now that you know some information about Pfaffenberger, let's watch a little bit of the Nuremberg trial.
The tribunal will recall that in the showing of the moving picture,
that moving picture would be Billy Wilder's film, which the court doesn't know is a psych warfare operation masquerading as a documentary.
The tribunal will recall that in the showing of the moving picture, with respect to one of the camps, there was a showing of sections of human skin taken from human bodies in the Buchenwald concentration camp.
This is a map showing the camps. To the right is a crematory oven and dead bodies. It's an image against the wall of the courtroom. Speaking is United States Prosecutor Thomas J. Dodd. This white thing is a cloth under which is a shrunken head. This is a board with tattooed skin pinned on it. The Germans on trial are over here out of view. The judges are right here.
Attached to the exhibit is an extract of an official United States Army report describing the circumstances under which this exhibit was obtained, and that extract is set forth in document 3420 PS. Which I refer to in part. It's entitled Mobile Field Interrogation Unit Number 2, PW Intelligence Bureau, the bulletin. 13, Concentration Camp Buchenwald. Preamble. The author of this account is P.W. Andreas Pfaffenberger. 1 Koi 9 Landeschützen BN. 43 years old and of limited education. He is a butcher by trade. This exhibit, which is on the table, is a human head with the skull bone removed, shrunken, stuffed, and preserved. The Nazis had one of their many victims decapitated after having had him hanged, apparently for fraternizing with a German woman, and fashioned this terrible ornament from his head. The last paragraph of the official United States Army report, from which I have just read, deals with the manner in which this exhibit was acquired.
The Pfaffenberger affidavit becomes an official United States Army report at Nuremberg. The last paragraph of the official United States Army report from which I have just read deals with the manner in which this exhibit was acquired. It reads as follows. There I also saw the shrunken heads of two young Poles who had been hanged for having relations with German girls. That's the Pfaffenberger affidavit. Thomas J. Dodd reads the passage of the Pfaffenberger affidavit, which tells of human skin fashioned into lampshades, thereby further instilling into mainstream culture a myth that will traumatize generations of Jewish 10 to 12-year-olds, making a worldview-defining deep impact on them. It's problematic from a legal standpoint that Thomas J. Dodd uses the Pfaffenberger affidavit to describe specific objects because Pfaffenberger hadn't been at the camp for quite some time, probably years, but the prosecution fixes this by misinforming the judge. American Chief Prosecutor Robert Jackson tells the judge, I merely want to give you the answer to the question which you asked me as to the whereabouts of Pfaffenberger. My information is that these affidavits were taken by the American Army at the time it liberated the people in these concentration camps. At the same time the films were taken and the whole evidence that was available gathered, this witness was present at the concentration camp, and at that time his statements were taken. Isn't it great that your great-grandparents and grandparents' tax dollars were used by government agencies to lie to your great-grandparents and grandparents so that you then grew up believing lies also? The whole Pfaffenberger fraud could be exposed by a wilting cross-examination. And indeed, Andreas Pfaffenberger himself is brought to Nuremberg. On Friday, defense attorney Kurt Kaufman says, I will proceed with the cross-examination on Monday. But over the weekend, Thomas J. Dodd prevents that from happening. He's not going to let his famous Nuremberg presentation be ripped into pieces. Dodd does some kind of intimidation behind the scenes, possibly even physically restraining Kaufman from coming to court on Monday. By Monday, Kaufman is nowhere to be found in the courtroom, and Dodd informs the judge. May it please the court, with reference to the prospective witness Pfaffenberger, over the weekend it occurred to us, after talking with him, that perhaps if defense counsel had an opportunity to talk to him, we might save some time for the court. Accordingly, we made this witness available to Dr. Kaufman for conversation and interview. He has talked with him as long as he has pleased, and has notified us that in view of this conversation, he does not care to cross-examine him, and as well other counsel for the defense have no desire to cross-examine him. The presiding judge responds, Then the witness Pfaffenberger can be released? That is what we would like to do at the order of the court. Very well. The Nuremberg trial is an epic triumph of justice, only in the sense that a Steven Spielberg film is an epic triumph of justice. They need a dumb-dumb portrayal of evil to be that. Take Raiders of the Lost Ark. The Nazis have the unmitigated gall to steal the biblical Ark of the Covenant until God melts their faces off and makes their heads explode. When dumb involves traumatic shock, it's hard to see the dumb. That's a major strength of the Holocaust myth, of movie scripts, of the lampshade story, and of the Nuremberg shrunken head presentation. There was a struggle between the Jews and the Nazis, and the Jews won. That's why Jews are portrayed in movies as the greatest people on earth and the Nazis as the worst. The Nuremberg trial and Raiders of the Lost Ark are about the winners using their power to create self-serving, dumb-dumb portrayals of evil. If Spielberg had known as a young person in the 1950s that the lampshade story was really a psych warfare created myth, and the rest of the Holocaust story was also a myth, would he have still portrayed the Germans this way as an adult? Because there is an ethnogenetic, biological, group evolutionary strategy component, the answer may be yes. Or, considering the following audio, it may be no.
No, I was a scared kid. I was a scared kid long before the missile crisis, and I think I was sort of born a nervous wreck. And I think movies were one way to find, you know, a way of transferring my own private horrors to everyone else's.
If we compare this image of C.D. Jackson holding up an alleged human pelvis ashtray with this cover of Life magazine, which he published 16 years later, we can see what happened in the subsequent years after the war. Who would have thought, but the same Americans who helped create the Holocaust myth then went on to create the Cold War. The methods of the C.D. Jackson crowd were so successful at denazifying Europe that they then tried to decommunize Europe and the world. Communism now becomes the dumb-dumb portrayal of evil used to justify war. This can be seen by the deliberately terrible picture of Khrushchev. And look where they're taking us. But it's 1961, and John F. Kennedy doesn't want to commit combat troops into Vietnam, much to C.D. Jackson's dismay. Since C.D. Jackson is one of the creators of the Holocaust hoax, let's do a Google search on C.D. Jackson and hoax. Something odd comes up. We find that Jackson bought the Zapruder film. That's the biggest piece of evidence in the John F. Kennedy assassination. We'll get to that in a moment, but first a quick word about communism. Communism under Joseph Stalin and his secret police was a murderous regime. Part of this might have been due to Jewish ethnogenetic revenge under the disguise of the moral high ground of communism. For instance, Kevin MacDonald writes, similarly, Jews were placed in charge of security in the Ukraine, which had a long history of anti-Semitism and became a scene of mass murder in the 1930s. Regardless of how much truth might be in that theory, by the mid-1950s, communism was different. It was a logical, normal, and understandable response to colonialism. A response that people had a right to choose for themselves. Back to C.D. Jackson buying the Zapruder film, we go to a book called The Chairman, written by Kai Bird. We read that C.D. Jackson, The Time Life executive had just bought the rights to an 8mm movie shot by Abraham Zapruder, a Dallas businessman who had chanced to catch most of the assassination sequence on film. Zapruder's film was to become a key piece of evidence for both the commission and its critics in the years to come. C.D. Jackson is an expert at lying to the public. Could he also have been involved in lying to the public about the JFK assassination? In the following passage, notice how Jackson is involved at the highest levels of the JFK investigation. On January 20, 1964, Jackson sent McCloy, a member of the Warren Commission, a series of blown-up transparencies reproduced from Zapruder's film sequence of the assassination. In an accompanying note, he told McCloy, "Our scrutiny of these stills indicates one thing we did not notice when looking at the movie, and one other thing that you seem to be in doubt about. I think there is no question but that the first shot actually took place behind the sign." The point isn't about the bullets, it's that Jackson is involved. We go on to read. McCloy's doubts were only heightened when he and other commissioners viewed the Zapruder movie. As C.D. Jackson's transparencies made clear, the Zapruder film shows that Kennedy had already been shot once as he emerged from behind the traffic sign. So we've seen C.D. Jackson involved at Buchenwald, then we've seen him pushing for the Cold War, and now we see him being involved with the JFK investigation. I think Lee Harvey Oswald probably killed Kennedy, but the idea that someone in the C.D. Jackson crowd did it is compelling. The motive would have been that Kennedy was messing up in the world struggle against communism. Could C.D. Jackson really have been that big of a lunatic? How about balloonatic? In an article appropriately titled First Comes the Lie, C.D. Jackson and Political Warfare, Professor Blanche Wiesen Cook tells us about an anti-communist balloon-releasing operation. C.D. Jackson was acknowledged as the leading balloonatic and was particularly delighted by the success of this project, especially the helplessness of the authorities to do anything about it. C.D. Jackson, Harold Stassen, and columnist Drew Pearson released the first balloons on 19 August. Soviet planes attempted to shoot them down, but it was impossible. There were 11,000 balloons carrying 13 million leaflets to boost the morale of the entire non-communist population and to fortify spiritual resistance until the Day of Liberation arrived. Later in the article, we learn that this program dropped leaflets by balloon at the rate of 14 million a month. But when a revolt finally did happen in Hungary, Jackson became exasperated with Eisenhower for not supporting it. We read, on 19 November 1956, Eisenhower finally answered C.D. Jackson's many memos demanding action. "I know that your whole being cries out for action. I assure you that the measures taken there by the Soviets are just as distressing to me as they are to you. But to annihilate Hungary is in no way to help her. CDJ agreed that bombs over Budapest would not ensure liberation, but," he wrote Henry Luce, the owner of Time and Life magazines, "there was an awful lot of legitimate theater sorely needed right now." Theater in this sense meaning military action. C.D. Jackson felt betrayed. Blanche Wiesen Cook later writes, "In 1958, C.D. Jackson resigned from Eisenhower's administration altogether. From that moment on, Time Inc. shifted allegiance and began to promote John F. Kennedy for the presidency, presumably because they thought Kennedy would take a stronger military stance against communism." So you can imagine C.D. Jackson's feelings toward Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs invasion. Let's watch a video about the Bay of Pigs.
In February 1960, Mikoyan, deputy premier of the Soviet Union, comes to Cuba. Welcomed by Castro and Guevara, he negotiates the purchase of sugar, but also the sale of arms, and a sizable credit for technical assistance. All this under the suspicious eye of the United States. 3 months later, Che asked the North American oil companies to refine Soviet crude. The companies refuse. Castro expects military intervention and prepares to meet it. During the night of April 17, 1,500 mercenaries land at the Bay of Pigs. The veterans of the Sierra Maestra, Fidel, Raul Castro, and Che Guevara are at the head of the armed forces. And contrary to all expectations, the invaders are crushed. It is a complete fiasco and a humiliation for Kennedy, the newly elected president of the United States.
Es un símbolo para todos los pueblos oprimidos. Playa Girón es la primera derrota del imperialismo en América Latina, pero también es una de las primeras derrotas del imperialismo en escala mundial.
That's a pig dressed up as Uncle Sam holding a bag of dollars being kicked out of Cuba. If Jackson felt betrayed by Eisenhower, then imagine this. And what about Vietnam, our next showdown? If you look at a table of American deaths in Vietnam, they start in 1964. Kennedy got shot at the end of 1963. When he was shot, the number was close to zero. Later, it was 58,000. It's as if Kennedy had been a roadblock to that escalation. In other words, the Bay of Pigs and not committing combat units into Vietnam may have been motives for American anti-communists to assassinate Kennedy. And those American anti-communists tend to be the founding members of the CIA, who are now ex-members and disgruntled. We find an example on the Warren Commission, of all places, Alan Dulles. But he shouldn't be on the commission. He should be on the list of suspects. In the book, The Mighty Wurlitzer, How the CIA Played America, by Professor Hugh Wilford, we see a picture of a man smoking a pipe. That's Alan Dulles, member of the Warren Commission. And in the book, we learn that after the Bay of Pigs, Kennedy forced Dulles out of the CIA. We read, Dulles stepped down in November 1961, his publicly brave face concealing a profound inner sense of humiliation and betrayal. We were in good hands when C.D. Jackson shared the Zapruder film with Alan Dulles and John McCloy. And these three all know each other well. They are among the secret founders of Radio Free Europe, the station that encouraged the Hungarians to revolt. When you read this book, and this book, all about the CIA in the 1950s, you get a profile of a sequel to the Holocaust myth. It's widely known that in the late 1940s and 1950s, the CIA influenced journalists for anti-communist purposes. But what's never been pointed out is that prior to that, psych warfare influenced American journalists to promote the Holocaust myth. We'll give a solid example from the New York Times and show that this guy is connected to psych warfare. But first we'll look at how one investigative journalist, investigating CIA-influenced journalists, almost backtracked into the Holocaust myth. That would be Carl Bernstein of Woodward and Bernstein Watergate fame. We read, many journalists who covered World War II were close to people in the Office of Strategic Services, the wartime predecessor of the CIA. More important, they were all on the same side. When the war ended and many OSS officials went into the CIA, it was only natural that these relationships would continue. Also keep in mind the Holocaust myth while reading the following Bernstein passage. You had a gang of people who worked together during World War II and never got over it, said one agency official. The article mentions the usual suspects. For many years, Luce's personal emissary to the CIA was C.D. Jackson. Bernstein then writes, by far the most valuable of these associations, according to CIA officials, have been with the New York Times, CBS, and Time Inc. Bernstein's article even mentions an incident where the CIA gave a New York Times journalist a briefing paper, and the journalist gave it to the printers and put his name on it. That's interesting because it's quite similar to the example we're about to give. We go back to the Buchenwald table. When a delegation of United States senators went to Buchenwald and viewed the table objects here, the senators were not told it was a psych warfare operation, which began a bad precedent of covert operations fooling elected officials. But did it also begin covert operations using journalists to fool the public about the Holocaust myth? This is the second front page New York Times article on a concentration camp. The problem is that it uses nearly verbatim sentences from the psych warfare movie directed by Billy Wilder. Let's compare.
The ovens of extremely modern design and heated by Coke were made by a concern which customarily manufactures baking ovens. The ovens of extremely modern design and heated by Coke The ovens of extremely modern design and heated by Coke were made by a concern which customarily manufactures baking ovens. Were made by a concern which customarily manufactures baking ovens. 1,200 civilians walked from the neighboring city of Weimar to begin a forced tour of the camp. There are many smiling faces, and according to observers, at first the Germans act as though this were something being staged for their benefit. At first, the Germans act as though this were something being staged for their benefit. At first, the Germans act as though this were something being staged for their benefit. One of the first things that the German civilians see as they reach the interior of the camp is the parchment display. On a table for all to gaze upon is a lampshade made of human skin. One of the first things that the German civilians see as they reach the interior of the camp is the parchment display. One of the first things that the German civilians see as they reach the interior of the camp is the parchment display.
Reporters are supposed to see with their own eyes and write with their own words, but Gene Kurovan's words are coming from a propaganda movie script. A court of law would call it plagiarism, but we'll call it cooperation. Involving the sharing of a script which has not yet been made into a movie. It's exactly what Bernstein's article is about, except it didn't start with the Cold War. It began with the Holocaust myth. To summarize, after C.D. Jackson and others manufactured the Holocaust myth to justify war, they then went on to portray communism in a way to justify war. Because these people already knew how to fool everybody and were experienced in covert operations, you've got to wonder if they had anything to do with the JFK assassination. All this brings up a novel by Philip K. Dick called Time Out of Joint, written in 1958. In the book, the main character is trapped in a government-created 1950s alternate reality where the daily small-town newspaper is secretly manufactured by the government to make the main character unwittingly support the war. And at one point, he reads a magazine. Something like Life, but the paper was not as high quality as the Luce Publications paper. On an unconscious level, Philip K. Dick had an idea of what was going on. We look up Buchenwald at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum website and read, "The SS often shot prisoners in the stables and hanged other prisoners in the crematorium area." That's actually true, but it needs to be understood. We find a document from an American military trial. affidavit of Hermann Pister, commandant of concentration camp Buchenwald, concerning special treatment there. If you remember, Hermann Pister was the Buchenwald commander from 1942 on. Pister states, "The only special treatment I know of is the execution of Russian commissars and politruks who had been transferred to the concentration camp Buchenwald from prison camps by the German army. As far as I recollect, up to the year 1943, these persons were not taken into the concentration camps, but were executed immediately after their arrival. Their execution was ordered exclusively by the Reich Security Main Office." So Pister admits to executing commissars and politruks. But who are commissars and politruks? In Encyclopedia Britannica Online, we find an entry for the Red Army and read, "Political advisors called commissars were attached to all army units to watch over the reliability of officers and to carry out political propaganda among the troops." We then go to Ivan's War, a book about the average Soviet soldier during World War II, and learn about commissars and politruks. But in 1939, the army still labored under the burden of constant political interference. For the regular soldiers, this aspect of life was ruled by the political commissars, who operated at the regimental and battalion level, and political officers, the Soviet term is politruk, who worked within the companies and lower units. As well as working as the party's spy, an individual politruk was likely to combine the functions of a propagandist with those of army chaplain, military psychiatrist, and school prefect. On page 65, we read that most Soviet soldiers looked at the politruk's clean boots, smooth hands, and unused cartridge belts and sensed hypocrisy. On the next page, we read, "The fact that many politruks, whose education tended to be better than average, were Jews, was probably a factor too." The head of the commissar system was Lev Mekhlis, a sinister figure identified more with covert arrests than with soldiering. Mekhlis would issue orders to his commissars such as, "Teach all personnel how to rush into attack." Just 2 weeks before the invasion of the Soviet Union, Hitler's headquarters issued an order to kill captured commissars. 10 months later, in May 1942, however, the commissar order was rescinded at the urging of German field commanders. In the book The Trial of the Germans, Eugene Davidson writes, "Some have concluded that several hundred commissars were executed in the early months of the campaign." So when we read Pister's 1947 affidavit, we can surmise that the Buchenwald executions were due to the commissar order. Pister's recollection of killing commissars and politruks up to the year 1943 loosely corresponds with the rescinding of the commissar order in May 1942. All this gives us a better understanding of the passage at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum that the SS often shot prisoners in the stables and hanged other prisoners in the crematorium area. They may have been Jews, but they were killed because they were commissars and politruks.
Gold-filled teeth were extracted from bodies before incineration. The ovens of extremely modern design and heated by coke were made by a concern which customarily manufactures baking ovens. The firm's name is clearly inscribed.
That would be J.A. Toepf and Sons, which is mentioned in the New York Times also. On a technical level, one could see some overlap between a baking oven and a cremation oven, but on an emotional level, that's highly disturbing. A baking oven company switches to a cremation oven company once Hitler rises to power. As it turns out, the Buchenwald Memorial Museum has an online exhibit on Toepf and Sons, the engineers of the final solution. We click on exhibition, and we can learn a lot about the company, the brothers, the employees, the products. Products. Are we going to find baking ovens? We read that they had begun developing crematory furnaces in 1914. They were involved in silo construction. Silos are cylinders that farms hold grain in. They produced grenades and spare parts for aircraft. But they never made baking ovens.
The ovens, of extremely modern design and heated by coke, were made by a concern which customarily manufactures baking ovens. The firm's name is clearly inscribed.
It's a psychologically disturbing notion, thought up by someone in psych warfare who was working on a movie script. People are afraid of Holocaust denial because they think it promotes Adolf Hitler. But it's not as if Hitler becomes a celebrated person once the Holocaust myth is broken. Rather, the true lesson of World War II becomes apparent, that being that it's Hitler's militarism that led to millions of deaths. Hitler must have known that Stalin had an apparatus to put most 18 to 30-year-old men in the USSR between him and the German army.
I just want to also say that Congressman Paul, I've heard him now in many debates talking about bringing our troops home and about the war in Iraq and how it's failed.
The proper thing would be to denounce Hitler and militarism in the same breath. But because that lesson was never learned, presidential candidate John McCain brings up Hitler to support militarism.
How it's failed. And I want to tell you that that kind of isolationism, sir, is what caused World War II. We allowed Hitler to come to power with that kind of attitude of isolationism and appeasement.
Okay.
I just finished having Thanksgiving with the troops, and their message to you is, the message of these brave men and women who are serving over there is, let us win. Let us win.
This is Mac on the Military Channel. He stars in and produces the show Future Weapons.
Tree Marine's best friend.
When the Marine Corps needs to take out bad guys in bunkers and fortified positions, they turn to the small. It's versatile, lightweight, and absolutely lethal.
But you can't see around corners with it. For that, you need something else. The cutting-edge corner shot.
If the Holocaust myth was ever exposed, then you'd see that Mac is very much like Hitler. Hitler also loved NATO weapons, Wunderwaffen, as they were called. The Nazis used the first helicopters in combat, the first jets, the first rockets. Being impressed by a NATO weapon is one of the lamest things a grown-up can do in their life. The Arabs and the American Indians have something in common. When they resisted having their land taken away, they got painted with a dum-dum portrayal of evil, which then justified military action against them. The programming on the Military Channel parallels the genre of the Western.
I'm on my way to a remote test site south of Jerusalem.
South of Jerusalem would be land taken from the Arabs in 1967.
I'm on my way to a remote test site south of Jerusalem to check out their latest surveillance creation, a tactical eye in the sky that can relay information instantly to the guys on the front line. In fact, it's so small, all of the parts can be carried in a backpack.
This is it, fully assembled. That's the backpack. Tell me the stuff that's in the backpack.
Basically, this backpack can store up to 3 air vehicles. Their payload depends on the configuration.
Weinstein is a European Jewish last name. The Holocaust myth was needed by European Jews to take the land he's standing on. Holocaust belief / denial falls under a larger dichotomy of militarism / peace. The reason Holocaust denial is not on Hitler's side in this diagram is because militarism needs dum-dum portrayals of evil to validate its existence, and Holocaust denial exposes a dum-dum portrayal of evil. This movie discusses Eisenhower's role in the Holocaust myth, but it's important to be aware that that's not the only source of the myth. It came from a lot of other places as well, which we can't get into. The Eisenhower angle is just one part. What happened to these Germans on the tour? It was decided that the city of Weimar, where they lived, was to be part of East Germany. So 3 months after this tour, the U.S. Army pulled out and the Soviet Army came in. These people then began their lives under communism as dictated by Joseph Stalin. The Buchenwald camp then became a Soviet concentration camp for Germans. We read on the Buchenwald website that when the Soviets put the Germans into the camp, hunger and isolation were the primary characteristics of everyday life. According to official Soviet documents, 7,113 persons died in Special Camp 2 Buchenwald. They were buried in mass graves, their families receiving no notification of death. One gets the impression that the Holocaust myth was about elites like Eisenhower and C.D. Jackson lying to the masses. But the average American soldier wanted the Holocaust myth. He wanted to believe that at the beginning of his adult life, he'd gone to Europe to risk everything in an epic battle over evil. The Holocaust myth is an example of the elites giving the masses what they want. I want to advocate always having warmth and kindness toward all Jewish people. I've had not just Jewish friends, but Jewish best friends, and when I think of them, words that come to mind are generous, nice, interesting, funny, cool aesthetics. Everyone is an individual. It's too easy to focus on how Jews benefit from the myth, but if you know several Jewish people, you likely know one or two who are chronically depressed over the Holocaust. Compassion is in order because today's generation of Jews have been lied to, just like everybody else. This album came out in 1980, and like all Earth, Wind & Fire albums, we feel a vibe of peace, love, and understanding. Maurice White said, "We live so close, yet so far away. Fear has been our separator."